All right.
Minnesota Appellate Court is now in session. The Honorable Francis J. Connelly presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. And with me today is Judge Reyes and Senior Judge Smith. We're happy to be in Rochester. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This matter is being live streamed in audio recording. So our first case is A23-0663 in the matter of the welfare of the child of DJT and NLT. Counsel, whenever you're ready, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin.
Judge Conley, I was planning to use the
please
podium,
do.
Just making sure.
Yes,
that's what I did
please
last
do.
Month.
Please do.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court and counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll. I am the attorney for the appellants, DJT and NLT, along with my co-counsel, Aaron Rapier. Mr. Rapier will be addressing you on rebuttal, and I will be handling the principal argument this morning. The appellants are also present for today's argument.
Thank you.
Your Honors, we are here today on an appeal following the district court's denial of the appellant's request for an evidentiary hearing on their motion to revoke their consents to adopt that were executed on February 9, 2017. Ultimately, the relief that the appellants asked for today is that this court reverse and remand the decision of the district court that denied their motion with directions to set this matter on for an evidentiary hearing so that this matter may be decided on its merits. For a brief factual background, Your Honors, in November 2016, Houston County filed a termination of parental rights petition alleging that the appellant subjected their...
You know, Ms. Stoll, I think we are familiar with the facts, and you only have 15 minutes, so why don't you continue, and then I know my colleagues will have some questions. So.
All right, of course. I can skip right to where we are then in terms of everything. You know, Your Honors, what I ultimately want to make sure I get out this morning during my arguments is this. As is borne out in the supporting affidavits and arguments on the record before the court, Houston County made numerous misrepresentations and unfounded assumptions about the parents' religious beliefs. These were perpetuated by medical providers, the guardian ad litem, and ultimately the district court. In essence, Houston County weaponized the parents' religion and relied on these incorrect and baseless assumptions to make religion a central tenet of this case. These false representations and assumptions were made to convince the district court and the parents that a termination of parental rights was inevitable, that their religious beliefs were a permanent barrier to family integrity. It wasn't until after signing the consents to adopt that the parents learned of the extent of these false representations on which they ultimately relied when they signed their consents to adopt. As the brief set forth, Your Honors, when we have a consent to adopt executed under 260C.515 subdivision 3, case law and the statute both make very clear that there's only really one basis upon which parents can revoke a consent to adopt, and that's based on fraud.
Ms. Stoll, before we get to your arguments as to the merits of the fraud, I will just say, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I have a problem applying the 6-year statute of limitations for fraud when Rule 22 deals with 90 days. And I understand you're very careful in your pleading, but, you know, in looking at the limitations, the statute of limitations, 541.051 subdivision 6, for relief on the ground of fraud, in which case the cause of action shall not be deemed to have accrued. Now, the problem I'm having with the 6-year statute applying is the cause of action. I mean, technically, this all was the result of permanency proceedings to original TPR. And would you concede that Rule 22 specifically has a 90-day deadline in order to bring any motions for relief from judgment?
Judge Conley, I can concede that's what Rule 22 says, but I will not concede that that rule applies to this case.
Why not?
Because I'll give a couple of reasons for that. First, Your Honor, both arguments were made to the district court, were rejected by the district court, and those...
Oh, I'm aware of that. The question is whether the district court erred by rejecting those arguments, but please continue, Estelle.
Sure, but related to that, Your Honor, if you look at the findings of fact, the respondent, who is the cross appellant in this case, did not challenge those findings, that this was not a motion brought under Rule 22.
I know, but my question is, it should have been. The concern I have is not just the plain language of the rule, but would it be your position if the statute of limitations was 15 years, would it be your position that someone could move to revoke an adoption on the basis of fraud 15 years after the adoption?
Based on the current law we have today, yes.
What about if it was 20 years?
Based on the current law, yes, Your Honor.
How could that possibly make sense when the main thing we want in all permanency decisions, besides the best interest of the child, is the need for permanency, matters to come to an end? And I'm not so sure, here you're asking for the general statute of limitations for fraud under 541.051 to apply, as opposed to the rule. Now, I understand your position is, well, we didn't challenge it pursuant to the rules for relief from judgment. We did it pursuant to revocation of the grounds of fraud. But for example, in the criminal side, post-conviction relief motions have to be brought within 2 years of the final conviction. And, that's a harsh deadline. And we see a lot of appellants make the argument, well, this really isn't a petition for post-conviction relief. This is, something else. And I guess the concern I have is that you're bringing something else really just to try to get around the rule, which should apply for all of the policy reasons I've just articulated. Now, why am I wrong, Ms. Stoll?
Okay, so there is going to be multiple parts, Your Honor. I'm hoping I can make my way through those.
Go right ahead.
So, starting with I don't do any criminal law, Your Honor, but my understanding is that, again, when we look at post-conviction relief, it's explicit in the rules or the statutes how much time you have to appeal. And I hear Your Honor's question and concern that Rule 22 includes a 90-day limitation. I think what is missing that needs to be acknowledged on the record today, and I believe the district court acknowledged, is the fact that a Rule 22 motion is a very particular type of motion. You can bring a motion for relief from a current order under various grounds,
including fraud.
But the definition of fraud under Rule 22 is not the same as the definition of fraud as is set forth in the case law, specifically petition of Anderson. They're two different types of fraud. And so if we're looking at the case law with Anderson and from that—
What kind of fraud under Anderson are you talking about?
Your Honor, I'm talking about the four-factor analysis that I believe is cited in my brief. I believe it's the Strait case, which is the four-factor analysis. And I believe that originates from Minnesota Digest. I know it's cited in my brief.
Right. I guess my question is, how is the fraud that you're referring to in case law, how is that different than the fraud that is referenced in Rule 22?
Because Rule 22 is when you ask for relief from a current order.
Okay. And that's a key point. Isn't the relief that is being sought from the final order from the district court?
No.
Why not?
It's to revoke the consent to adopt.
But the consent to adopt was incorporated into the district court's order. That consent to adopt doesn't exist by itself anymore. It's part of the district court order. And if it's part of the district court order now, then the challenge for fraud can only be brought against the district court's final order, which means Rule 22 applies then, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I guess the way that I look at it is if we are successful following an evidentiary hearing and revoking a consent to adopt, we then would not have a child that was ever available for adoption, and that order would by extension be...
Right, but you're trying to collaterally attack the consent to adopt. It's like trying to collaterally attack a stipulation for dissolution of marriage. That doesn't exist on its own once the district court adopts that. That becomes part of the district court order. It doesn't have a separate existence in and of itself anymore, right?
I'm not trying to provide a dissatisfactory answer. I'm still trying to get to Judge Conley's ultimate question, and I'll do my best, Judge Reyes, to answer your point as well. I do believe I understand the question. So what I was trying to kind of transition to, and I'll try my best to take a stab at this Rule 22 issue again as a part of my response. So we have the findings of fact by the district court, and I understand we have the appeal, but there was no challenge brought to the findings of fact by the district court, which included Rule 22 did not apply. And so those are the findings that we have here today.
But it doesn't matter. I guess I will say I share Judge Connolly's concerns, and I think he articulated very well the parallel with post-conviction relief. Just because somebody says, this is what I'm challenging, courts can look at it, including on appeal, and say, wait a minute, no. We realize you styled it as this particular challenge, but it's really this challenge. And I think that's comparable to what we have here. I think the pleading was, you know, done very well to try to avoid Rule 22, but as a practical matter, I don't know if we can avoid Rule 22 at all.
I'm not coming up with a different response than I've already given. I'm hoping perhaps on rebuttal, Mr. Rapier might be able to take a stab at the question. And I do see my time is quickly expiring, so I apologize. I'm not giving an answer that you are all looking for this morning on that. But
well, I mean, who knows? We haven't decided the case yet.
Not yet.
But why don't you, in the remaining time you have, since we kind of drilled you a lot, not on the merits, why don't you discuss the merits of why, let's say, for the sake of argument, we agree with you that the six-year statute does apply. Why should there have been an evidentiary hearing on these facts, Ms. Stahl?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So just going to the merits then with the time that I have remaining, you know, this two-step analysis is ultimately what the court applied starting with prima facie. And all I will say is I will rely on my brief with pointing out how the district court erred in its order, given that it acknowledged it was doing a prima facie analysis by weighing evidence, by disregarding allegations set forth in the appellant's supporting affidavits, as well as relying upon contradictory evidence brought by the respondent. Turning to the ultimate elements, and I think the ones that I would like to particularly focus on, the elements that are specifically found in the Anderson case, really goes to the first element, which is the false representation of a material fact susceptible to human knowledge. Our briefs, go into a pretty significant amount of detail, pointing out the various misrepresentations and make citations to the appellant's affidavits. But what I want to make sure to focus on is this. Ultimately, a false representation can be done by a party to the proceeding or by a third party, and that is set forth in the cases that are cited in our principal brief. Further, representation that is false can happen by omission. That is also cited in our brief. False representation can also come about by misrepresentations or false representations as to the law. And I think the component I want to focus on that is particularly troubling is the transcripts and what all took place with regard to the discussion about the parents' religious beliefs.
When did the appellants learn of these alleged false misrepresentations?
Judge Smith, my recollection from the record, and I apologize if this is wrong, is that they first started learning of these misrepresentations of fact in the days and months after, as the months and years went on, after consulting with other attorneys, other professionals, looking at what all took place. That's when the extent of the misrepresentations.
But they had an attorney at the time, though, did they not? At the time of the consents were signed?
They did, Your Honor, but I'm not aware of any case law that the respondent cited, nor am I aware of any that exists that states if you have an attorney that's representing you throughout the proceedings, that then you can't make an argument or assert that there was a false representation of material fact or what the law provides. And I think what is particularly perpetuated in this case, at least with regard to the relative search, is it starts with the county relying on an unrelated land dispute to deduce religious beliefs. May I just finish my
response? Please do. Please do.
The district court then adopts those, and we see that not only in the January 2017 transcript, but also in the April 2023 transcript. A review of the record before the district court bears out all of those numerous representations that resulted in erroneous rulings by the district court in its reliance on false representations of the parents' religious beliefs, which has just significantly permeated this case and is what brings us here today. Since my time has expired, Your Honors, I will leave it there, and Mr. Rapier will see you on rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stoll. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Hulitz. I'm the attorney for respondents. Heather Fee, a social worker, is here today with me. Judge of the Court of Appeals, Judge Conley, Judge Reyes, Judge Smith, Attorney Stoll, Attorney Rapier, may it please the court. Children are entitled to permanency or they are not. The appellants are asking this court to conclude children are not entitled to permanency. Appellants' end goal is to undo the adoption that occurred in 2017. That goal flies in the face of everything the Minnesota courts and legislators have done, made it clear for years that children deserve permanency. The appellant's goal destroyed the
You know, how would the average person be able to find out that fraud existed within 90 days from the order?
I don't know.
I mean, the whole point of the fraud is they're hiding something from you, which you have relied upon to grant the to give your consent to the adoption. And, you know, okay, he has a lawyer. Well, you know, everybody has a lawyer. That doesn't mean they get to discover the fraud within a timely basis. Don't you think, particularly since the statute references specifically in 260C.515-9, unless otherwise required by the Indian Child Welfare Act, blah, 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 a consent to adopt executed under this section shall be revocable upon acceptance by the court, except upon order permitting revocation issued by the same court after written findings that consent was obtained by fraud. Why doesn't that statute trump the rule?
I believe that Rule 22 trumps the statute.
Why? When have we ever said that? Don't we look to the statutes first, and or at the very least, aren't we supposed to sort of not rule, but interpret the statutes together with the rule? And here, this is a very specific, you know, the Rule 22 deals with, you know, upon motion, upon subservience or just, the court may relieve a party from a final order or proceeding and may order a new trial or grant such other relief as may be just for fraud, whether denominated intrinsic or extrinsic, misrepresentation or other misconduct of an adverse party. But here, the statute seems to be specific as it relates to revocation of consent obtained by fraud. And it seems to suggest, well, you know, 260C.515 does not give a time deadline. So I suppose that helps you. But then the general cause of action for fraud is 6 years. So again, while I think we can all appreciate it, indeed, I articulated that in my questions to Ms. Stahl, that, you know, it seems odd that you could be challenging adoption 6, 10, 15 years later, depending on what the statute says. You know, that's what the statute says, and they've been very careful, in fact, extraordinarily careful, to make clear that they're not moving for relief from the order. They're moving under a different statute. So why are they wrong and you're right?
Okay, well, in my brief, on page 8, I did cite the welfare of JR. The Supreme Court indicated that where a juvenile rule differs from rules and statutes that might otherwise apply, provisions of the rules governing juvenile protection proceedings are controlling. And that's on page 8 of my brief. So that's why I think—
And what was that case again?
In the welfare of JR.
Thank you.
And so I think that's why the rule supersedes the statute in this matter. And plus, as you know, juvenile protection rules are a very short timeline. And that's why the 90 days is very important for Rule 22. And the court was questioning Ms. Stahl about Rule 22, and he asked about the fraud. Specifically, we talked about Attorney Applehoff with their attorney in 2016-17. But what unique fact we have in this case is that on the time of consent on February 9th of 2017, later that morning, Attorney Applehoff gets an email from her expert about something about Gunderson Lutheran records or what, and they were wrong or something like that. However, that put her on notice, the 90 days fraud statute, in our opinion. So she had notice.
The fraud statute or the fraud rule?
The rule 2202. So she had notice that same day they signed a consent about a fraud issue, potential issue. I'm not saying it was a fraud issue, it was a potential issue that she could have explored, and she chose not to. And she was still representing the appellants in that time, because that was February 9th, 2017, because she sent a letter to the county and the potential adoptive parents in April 2017. So she was still actively representing them. So she could have done that within that time frame. So that's why I think Rule 22 applies in this case. Again, the director wanted to impose finality after 90 days. I quote that the welfare of SC on page 8. And again, welfare of the child of RDL, Supreme Court emphasized that child protection cases are to receive priority and should resolve quickly. But that attorney's sole reason.
So just so I absolutely understand your argument, let's say for the sake of argument, there has been fraud and everyone agrees with it. Fraud in the inducement, fraud in the misrepresentations, fraud everywhere. And if you don't bring your motion for relief within 90 days, you have no remedy. Is that the state's position?
That is the state's position, yes.
And the reason for that is the necessity for permanency, finality, you know, life goes on.
Correct.
Doesn't that result in, doesn't that become an absurd result? Because if somebody finds on day 91, they discover fraud and serious, significant fraud that took place. How is that just? How is that, you know, because we don't enforce rules or statutes that have absurd results.
I understand what you're saying, but my position would be that, like I said, child protection cases go very quickly. And I think Rule 22 applies over the statutes. And I guess in this case, that fraud, number one, I don't agree with the fraud didn't occur. And I think the 90-day rule would apply. And I just don't know that the parties who find out fraud on day 91, I don't know what their relief would be. But.
Why don't you turn to Ms. Stoll's arguments on the merits? Why, if we agree for the sake of argument that the 6-year statute applies, why is her client's not entitled to a an evidentiary hearing on the merits.
Okay. The district court made a finding that the allegations did not support prima facie case. So that's why I'm going on. Actually, I did a cross appeal, related appeal, I'm sorry, that to have for the courts deny Judge Torino's finding that that Rule 22 did not apply. So that's a cross appeal that I did. However, about the finding itself, she made findings that our documents did explain and provide context to the unrealistic claim of fraud. And then also, let's see here.
What about the allegations that it was misrepresented that if they didn't agree to the consent, you know, there would be adverse actions related to a TPR of other children? What about that?
Your Honor, that's an allegation only. Okay. I think it's an allegation based on not good facts. And that's why we're finding this.
Is there any evidence in the record besides the affidavits of Ms. Stoll's clients supporting that?
That's an allegation only on their records. Like I said, obviously we didn't have an evidentiary hearing, but I believe strongly that their allegations are unfounded. They're so vague. And like I said, Attorney Stahl and Rapier weren't the original attorneys on this case like 6-7 years ago. So they are just taking documents and putting them together, and the appellants are recollecting 6 years ago. And so I said this is a totally unfounded allegation in my case.
So let me ask you, the child was less than a year old at the time of the adoption. Is that accurate?
Yes. Well, she was
born April 4th of 2016.
Yes, and the adoption occurred in the 2017 area.
Okay.
She was young.
But the rules require that adoption take place within 6 months. Is that accurate as well?
Yes.
After removal from a home?
Well, this child was in the hospital for several months. And so by the time, you know, we put her into a non-relative foster care and then eventually turned her over to the potential adoptive parents, the adoption didn't take place, I think, until October 2017 at that time frame.
I guess my point is that permanency is required within a time frame,
right,
which is 6 months for a child of that age. So at some point there would have had to have been an adoption or return to the family within 6 months, right, under the rules?
Well, they signed a consent in February 9th of 2017. The adoption took place, I guess, is 8 months later, so.
I mean, there's a limited time frame for these things to happen under the rules.
Right, but then in reality, there are difficulties that come to play as well.
Okay.
Would you like me to continue about the merits or the Rule 22 argument?
I think the merits.
Okay.
All right. Please.
Okay. So like I said, Houston County's documents did explain and provide context to the appellant's unrealistic claim of fraud. And I think the court listened to that. And that's why she made the finding that it did not support a prima facie case for an evidentiary hearing and denied that hearing as well. Like I said, the allegations that the appellants made about having Houston County have unwritten policies or unfounded assumptions, that's not true. They are unrealistic assumptions that they relied on for their claim of fraud. And again, the court did say the parents have not provided sufficient documentation or argument to make a prima facie showing. That's in the district court order, page 14, paragraph 62. It's also an appellant's addendum on page 14. And then Ms. Stoll did talk a little bit about religion. She claimed that we weaponized the religion for them. However, you know, we engaged in a relative search, and part of that relative search includes looking at the best interest factors under 260C.212. And part of that look is subdivision 2, parens B, parens 6, is a religion factor. And we looked very seriously at that. We had concerns that this community did not have a practice about seeking medical care. We had mother and father statements to the doctors that said, let God heal her or take her. And that's concerning because this child came to us like within days of death. And so it was a very big case for us. And we had very strong concerns that we wanted to obviously save her and intervene to get her medical care. And from my understanding is that the parents had missed an appointment in April 2016. They canceled the appointment, and they didn't contact a medical provider until October 5th, and that appointment didn't happen until November. So there was a time frame where she got worse and worse. I know they said they had a picture attached that her belly was covered with blankets. Picture that we had attached to our briefs was her. I remember her stomach was the size of a basketball. She had little thick fingers. She had, this is all according to medical providers as well, she had creased on her back, indicating that she had lain for a long time. And the veins in her stomach had, take some time for them to, I don't know if they reversed or how that happened, but she was green, she had jaundice, so she was very, very sick.
Well, that's why a TPR petition was brought. I don't think there's any dispute as to the condition of the child, which prompted the TPR, the TPR petition, and then, you know, they shifted to adoption. What about the argument? Isn't your best argument that in terms of placement, that while it wasn't a relative, Ms. Stoll's clients chose the people themselves who, you know, were going to adopt the child?
Right, and that's definitely a part of the case. We were gearing up for trial, and then the attorney indicated that the family had chosen an adoptive family, which we thought was fine, and we researched them as well, and they chose them, and we didn't intervene in that action. They weren't our first choice was another relative placement in the county, but we did not object to them. In fact, they're here today. So obviously, the fact that the parents chose them was good to us. I mean, we did the background searches and things like that, so we were fine with that, Your Honor. So, let's see. If you want to know more about religion, like I said, we really scrutinized the religious factor in 260C212.
You can finish your thought.
Okay, thank you. Because we had had a 2014 case in Houston County, just steps away from our office, involving the Maranatha and a couple leaving the Maranatha, and we had heard and learned facts about that, and so we're concerned about the consequences of placing her back in a family unit in that community, which they take care of for medical care and things like that. So we're very concerned about this child, and we use the best interest analysis in every step we took. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word. Mr. Rapier.
May I please record?
Go right ahead.
In the brief time that I have left, I really want to focus on two things, if you'll allow me to do so. First, I want to address the issue you raised about the time limits. I don't know that I have the perfect answer to that question and how it fits with Rule 22. What we relied upon in the briefing was the case of, in the matter of the welfare of CRB, to Minnesota, a public court case. And in that case, it cites Howland, the Blue White Liberty Cab Company, for the following proposition. The Minnesota Supreme Court noted, now this is a quote from Halloran, a judgment may be set aside at any time. A judgment may be set aside at any time or after discovered fraud upon the court. So, Your Honor, so that's the best answer I have to your pointed question on this interplay.
But that's case law, though. Juvenile rules in particular basically override even other statutes or other rules, much less case law. How does that case apply to juvenile rules?
My answer to that, Your Honor, would be if the Minnesota Supreme Court is communicating to all of us, this is the rule without the qualification, you know, that that you're making, or without the insight that you're adding, we have to follow.
But, you know, and I have CRB in front of me. It's, you know, fraud on the court, as by Halloran said, fraud on the court exists where a court is misled as to material circumstances or its process is abused, resulting in the rendition of a judgment which would not have been given if the whole conduct of the case had been fair. Now, obviously, there's some language in there that helps you, but, you know, isn't this... I mean, isn't there a difference between fraud on the court and fraud on your clients? I mean, when I think of fraud on the court, I think of an affidavit, a perjurious affidavit being presented, you know, things like that. Whereas here, it seems to not rise to that level. Now, why am I wrong, Mr. Rapier?
Well, I don't think you're wrong because I don't think you said in your statement that perjury was necessary. It's just that those are the types of cases or the level of conduct to which you may allow fraud on the court. Until this panel, the Supreme Court says perjury is necessary for fraud on the court, then we can show fraud on the court in circumstances less than perjury. And we cited some cases that do that. Property distribution cases, personal injury cases, divorce cases. And there, it really wasn't about perjury. But I appreciate that perjury would rise to that level, but I don't think perjury is the minimum threshold to touch that level. I see I've got a minute 50 left.
I just had one quick follow-up question. So first of all, the CRB case, that's from the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's not from the Supreme Court.
You're correct.
But that case, did that interpret fraud with respect to Rule 22?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I think it was under Rule 16.
Okay, so it's not looking at how Rule 22 applies.
That statement is correct. And I think some additional context would be what Ms. Stoll was saying, was that there are the traditional elements of fraud, and then there is the fraud on the court. And they're not necessarily the same. They can be different. As Justice Connolly mentioned when he read the quote from that case, you know, was the presentation of the underlying case fundamentally unfair so that it constituted a fraud on the court? And in a minute I have left, if I can just direct you to one thing, if we can just look at one thing, this will show us how meaningful an evidentiary hearing in this case will be. If we look at Dr. Harris' affidavit, attached to it are the records from Gunderson that my office received and we requested. Look at those records, specifically at page 59, you will see the bile acid report that Cincinnati Children's in May, so after the family is weeks away from this hospitalization, you will see in May how Cincinnati Hospital, who has a mass spectrometer, reviewed this blood sample, sent it to Mayo. This is before November. This is in May. This is in April. Cincinnati Children's sent it to Mayo. Mayo then sends it to Gunderson, but Gunderson doesn't get it until May 19th. That's over a month after the family was out. And they're being judged and charged for knowing at the time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rapier. Thank you, Ms. Stoll. Thank you, Ms. Bublitz. We are very mindful of the important issues in this case, and we will be issuing our decision within 45 days. As opposed to 90. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.